The Mesolithic Neolithic site of Shekhadud in Sudan is one of the Institute of Archaeology of the Czech Academy of Sciences flagship sites. First found in the early 1960s by German archaeologist Karl-Heinz Otto, Shekhadud became known as a famous prehistoric archaeological site after a Sudanese-American joint expedition helped to publicize it in the early 1980s. The Czech Academy of Sciences Institute of Archaeology started investigating the site in 2021. I spoke with Dr. Ladislav Varadzin of Prague's Institute of Archaeology of the Czech Academy of Sciences, who has been heading the excavation, working in an international team including five Czechs, one of whom is his wife, Lenka Varadzinova. I started by asking him about the aim of the excavation.
The idea of the project is to understand the life strategies of people in arid areas which were lacking permanent open water bodies. So far, most of the research has been focusing on rivers and lakes. But there are these areas away from rivers and lakes, which we can call hinterlands or inlands. And these constituted and still constitute some 80% of the area of Sahel and Sahara as well. But here the investigations haven't been that thorough. So far we only know that there was some occupation in the past, and there are indications that it was important. It was not any secondary area for life compared to the rivers and lakes. The area we are investigating, it was not anomalous. It's been some system in something which was repeated, and it all happened out of the rivers, out of the Nile, in the mountains, in the hinterlands. So perhaps we are at the beginning of showing that there were hidden worlds not touched that much by archaeologists so far, which were independent on the rivers and lakes. And these could be areas of hidden world of life, but also there could be hidden corridors of movement of people from the southerly areas of Africa to the north. If we would be able to bring strong evidence for that, it means the people, the early people, even other types of hominins besides the Homo sapiens, could be able to move through these areas were not dependent on the rivers, which would turn the perspective of the current research. And so we ask the questions, how did the people cope with the dispersed water and food resources? What strategies did they use to mitigate natural vulnerability of the environment? Because it was only dependent on the local rainfall. In case of dry spells, everything could turn into the dust. So there were no natural buffers like the rivers and lakes were. So the bar for their adaptations was set much higher. We also asked what role in these mitigations played social relations, solidarity and alliances, things like that.
And what kind of people are we talking about? Were they still hunter-gatherers?
Yes, right. They were hunter-gatherers. But then later in, let's say, 6th millennium before Christ, another economic strategy or adaptation was spreading across Africa, and it's pastoralism or animal herding, which arrived in the Sahel around 5000 BC, let's say. So the scope of our project is from the very beginning, from the first occupation after the Ice Age, up to, let's say, 2000 BC, so it encompasses some 10,000 years.
Is there any crop agriculture?
It's a good question. This is a good question. Utterly recently, all scientists recognized that African domestication spread across Africa only during the so-called Neolithization, in the post-hunter-gatherers context. But some 3-4 years ago, there was a very important finding by our British-American colleagues who found that there were cultivation of local native African crops among the hunter-gatherers already. And their evidence comes from what is called pre-domestication phase. So it means you have up to 20% of wild crops had already some mutation, already been on the way to domestication. So this is very important finding. It's important that it's among hunter-gatherers already. So this is the evidence that Africans did cultivate it and did domesticate it even before any influences from the Near East. And the fact is that this is a very important point. This is the question of human cultural evolution. In the past, there were always, of course, present these questions. But there was a tendency to have one answer for them. Very famous Australian archaeologist, Gordon Child, he answered these questions, or he proposed answers. But in that time he was working only with the evidence which was available. But since then the evidence around the globe changed rapidly. And it shows that many similar things happened independently in different conditions. And sometimes what has been proposed by early archaeologists as the precondition for the change, it's reversed. First you have the change, and what was supposed to be a precondition you find only later as a result of this change. So it's changing perspective. This is a question of, for example, the beginnings of agriculture and domestication. So it has not one denominator. So that's why it's very important to reset the research worldwide in a multidisciplinary and multi-team work.
So at the time period you were interested in, there were big climatic changes going on?
Yes, this site was considered to be occupied only 6,200 years before Christ onwards. But we found during our two seasons that the beginnings of the local occupation is much older, around 10,000 years before Christ. So it means at the very beginning of the Holocene, and the onset of the Holocene was very important for the whole North Africa, because in that time the whole climate changed from glacial period, ice age, it turned in more humid conditions, and the monsoon rains penetrated more to the north, which allowed vegetation and animals to occupy what is today Sahel and Sahara, and what was absolutely uninhabitable. But since the beginning of the Holocene, this vast area opened for the ecosystem, including people. So actually what we have now in North Africa, you know, all the states of the Sahel and the Sahara, including Egypt and the Egyptian civilization, it's actually more or less direct continuation of this beginning of Holocene, which allowed the occupation. And we found out that in these hinterland areas, the people were present already at the very beginning, so they were certainly not secondary areas of interest. They were one of the first they were searching for. And this is when the ice age was shifted into what is called, it has a special term, it's called African Humid Period. And this African Humid Period, it was the, let's say, lush period for the North Africa. It's also called the period of Green Sahara. And this allowed the occupation and colonization of these vast areas. But in fact, the situation was more complicated. Even the African Humid Period, these areas, Sahel and Sahara, were always very suffering for this interseasonal variation. The dry and wet parts of the year, and the ratio between them was more to the dry. So the contrast between these two seasons was very hard, and it is very much affected the whole ecosystem. So it means also the people who had to cope with this interseasonal variation. Second, the period was not one homogeneous period. There were many spells and oscillations. So that's why at the same time we have to not only to study the people and their remains, but we have also to understand the ecology, past ecology, I mean the grasses and trees and which animals were living there, but also we have to reconstruct or investigate the changes in the rainfall, in the hydroclimate. And we are lucky because there were springs in the past of which remains are tufa and travertine deposits. And these allow to reconstruct these changes. So we believe we would be able not only to understand the local climate in the past, which will bring, you know, the real human scale to the responses to the climate changes, but also if we would succeed to build this model, the changes, it would be very important, a reference model for Northeast Africa, which is missing.
Just to tie it to the present day, do you think there's any hope offered for the current climate crisis by the fact that people in the past were able to adapt, or is it the situation just too different to really...
Well, yes, so of course, both answers are correct. Of course, things never repeat, so in this respect we are studying something unique, not only in time, but also in space. On the other hand, on a certain level of generalization, I believe we will be able to understand processes which happened in the past, and they can help us to understand the present and the future. in two respects. One respect is the natural one. And I said that we will try to reconstruct the hydroclimate, and the more higher resolution we get, the more we would be able to understand, especially the current Sahelian climate, because there's been many work done by hydrologists and climatologists to propose so-called skillful prediction, because it happened in 60s to 90s that the Sahel was there were no rains, almost no rains, and it caused dramatic, you know, changes in lives and even deaths of people and political instability and things like that. And it happens in waves. But the problem is we have no archival evidence for that. And these investigations can help very much. So I believe this data can be provided to the specialists for today's climate, and I believe they would use it for their understanding of what's going on now and in the future maybe. And the second, for the humans, of course, today the globe is inhabited by mostly very complex, large-scale communities. On the other hand, we are focusing on rather small-scale groups. So in this respect, it's not comparable. But this is like a laboratory case. So even today, if sociologists want to understand how society works, you work with a sample. And you select a specific group, and you define the conditions or how you select the groups, and on this you study a specific topics which you cannot understand in a complex. And this is actually what we do. So I think that especially the questions of solidarity and social networks and settlement and subsistence strategies can really, you know, everything is not only about technology, but also about planning and scheduling and human relations and things like that. So I believe this can contribute to our ideas about today and future.
And what was your impression of Sudan when you first visited?
Well, Sudan for me is like my second country. My feelings were very positive concerning the people, first of all. Sudanese are very honest people and hardworking, very friendly. And you can believe them, you can rely on them. But as archaeologist, I have to say it's a Klondike. There are so many things to be investigated. You know, it's really literally, it's littered. The surfaces are littered by sites and finds from prehistory and from historic periods as well. So in future, there are many questions that can be solved, you know, regarding the human environment relation in arid conditions and so on. In Africa, but even globally, which can be solved directly in Sudan, because it's really at hand. And as I said, nice people. I would say even stable conditions, although there was a political coup, even during the COVID times, it was not that easy. But still, if you compare it globally, it's a stable area to work in and to really develop longer term projects.
And is your wife also working on this project?
Yes. She's like a field manager, because she can perfectly manage everything and prepare. She's also a specialist in African rock art. She's very good in that. And she's published many books and articles. And thanks to her, we found the rock art in the area also. Prehistoric one, which although there were the expeditions before, they didn't see it.
And what's it like working with your wife, if I may ask?
Excellent, yes. No, because I can rely on many things, and we can discuss many things, and we have, you know, very good relations. And usually you are very tired after, let's say, 10 days or 2 weeks. You get very tired, and since then you go to a critical regime. So it means you do only things which are needed. And then easiness of communications is very important. But this is not relating only to my wife, but to all the team, because we are at the same time not only colleagues, we are friends.